This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the United States bombed Iraq. We have troops in Somalia and have considered the possibility of military action in Bosnia. The role of the U.S. military is changing as American foreign policy changes in the post-Cold War era. To help us examine some of the changes within the military, we called retired Rear Admiral Jean LaRock. LaRock is the founder of the Center for Defense Information, an independent research organization which analyzes military spending, policies, and weapons systems. LaRock began his naval service in 1940, and during his 31 years in active service, he commanded a variety of warships, including destroyers and guided missile cruisers. For 7 years, he worked in the Pentagon on strategic planning for the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Chief of Naval Operations. I asked him about the center's reaction to yesterday's airstrike.
Politically, it seems like a very harsh way to send a message to try to get a point across to the Iraqi government that there ought to be some way to work at this diplomatically. We recognize at the Center for Defense Information that the military is a heavy-handed, blunt instrument, and we think it not wise to kill a few people in order to make a point with the government. Politically, I think it was President Bush wanting to take one last swipe at Saddam Hussein before he left office. And I think also it tended to put President Clinton in a box, or President-elect Clinton. Clinton had to say something, and he would be uncomfortable opposing it, so he came out in support of what President Bush had done, which rather locks Clinton into the same situation that President Bush is already in.
What about militarily?
Well, militarily, it was simply a mosquito bite on Saddam Hussein, so we knock out a few of their anti-aircraft missiles. Actually, of course, there was no threat to our planes if we didn't fly over Iraq. If we're going to fly over Iraq, then, of course, we might expect that our planes would indeed be threatened or endangered. But we are, by our own decision, deciding to fly over a sovereign territory that we have simply said we may do so, and we ought to do so with impunity.
What kind of military technology did we take out in Iraq?
Well, we took out some old surface-to-air missiles, SA-2s and SA-3s, the same kind that were used in Vietnam, which were effective in Vietnam. They do go up to about 80,000 feet, and they could easily, but not easily, but they could knock out our planes that fly into Iraq. We took out, apparently, some anti-aircraft artillery. But the fact is that the Pentagon has not really made a good evaluation yet as to what damage was actually done. And we also don't know how many people were killed, if any, although there's some reports emanating that at least some people were killed at an anti-aircraft battery.
Does this strike set any military precedent for us?
Well, we've actually been doing this for quite some time. It's just a matter of level. After all, we picked a fight with Gaddafi about 5-6 years ago, shot down a couple of his planes. We've been sending our forces various places all over the world. After all, Grenada was simply one of a larger scale, Panama, larger scale. We in the United States have decided that we may, at any time we wish, whenever the president wishes, attack any country in the world. And, of course, we have the capability to bomb any country in the world within 24 hours with the aircraft based in the United States. Gives us a mighty long reach for our military force with quick reaction. And it's nothing new that we strike without warning. These are surprise attacks we made in Grenada, in Panama. And we did not tell the Iraqis when we were going to strike them. In fact, we've made something of a point of the fact that we're going to do this anytime we want, and there will be no more ultimatums.
I wonder if what you're saying is a fair criticism, because after all, Iraq was violating UN sanctions, and it was a multilateral force, not just a United States action.
Well, this was a United States action, supported by the British and the French. This was not a United Nations action, and no one pretends that it was. The Security Council did not authorize it, and the Resolution 688, which the President used to justify some of our action over there recently, says nothing at all about a no-fly zone, says nothing about the 32nd parallel, says nothing about shooting down Iraqi planes. That's all a U.S. action supported by the British and the French. Yes, there were some violations of the United Nations resolutions, to wit that the United Nations was now being denied by the Iraqis the opportunity to fly United Nations planes into Iraq, but that and one other minor one were negotiable. They could be handled with diplomacy, but we've taken it upon ourselves to use military action to ensure compliance south of the 32nd parallel based solely on the decision that the United States, France, and Britain made. Nothing to do with there's nothing in the UN Resolution 688 that even remotely suggests that authorizes U.S. military action in that part of Iraq.
What was the center's position on the intervention in Somalia?
Well, we're divided here at the center on that issue. Some of the military feel that it was an improper use of military force to by any measure. Personally, I supported the use of the military force, the military forces to go in and feed those starving people. I would hope that we'll be out of there in 6 months. I hope we can turn it over at that time to the United Nations. This was an urgent humanitarian effort which seemed to me to demand the attention of the world community. The world community did not seem to be able to get its act together to do it. In the meantime, people were literally dying before our eyes. So I supported sending the forces in there to feed the people and then urge our government to turn it over to the UN as quickly as possible.
What kind of budget changes await the military now?
Well, we're spending now at about the same level for the military that we spent during the height of the Cold War. The budget this year was $292 billion, almost $6 billion a week. And there is talk of reducing our military forces in size, and that should act to reduce our military spending. However, both Clinton and President Bush, but even more so President-elect Clinton, have supported weapons that even the Pentagon doesn't want. So the spending for the military will remain at about the same level as it is today, $6 billion a week.
Is the military being reshaped technologically or in terms of its troops because of the new kinds of deployment that we're seeing, the new kinds of foreign policy initiatives?
Not really. There's talk about that it ought to be done, but we're still building Cold War weapons to fight a nuclear war against somebody, presumably the Russians and the Ukrainians. In the meantime, of course, we are continuing to develop planes for rapid deployment, that is, weapons for rapid deployment to carry that by aircraft, and more light divisions, light infantry to facilitate going elsewhere in the world. So in one sense, we're still doing the old Cold War fighting capability development. At the same time, we're building forces to facilitate intervention elsewhere in the world.
I'm interested in what you think of Bill Clinton's choice of Les Aspin as Secretary of Defense and Warren Christopher as Secretary of State.
Well, I know nothing about Warren Christopher, except what I read in the papers, but I do know Les Aspin, and he certainly is a knowledgeable guy. I worked with him in the Pentagon when he was there as one of the whiz kids under Mr. McNamara. And Les Aspin is a thoughtful man, PhD, and he knows the military. And he came out in February this last year with a series of options. He indicated to Leon Panetta in a personal letter that he supported Option C, as he called it, which would have been a significant reduction in our military force structure. If he sticks to that, it'd be a very wise choice.
Are there certain changes that you're looking for under a Clinton administration or that you expect to happen under a Clinton administration?
Well, the Clinton administration, Mr. Clinton himself, promised a reduction of our military forces down to 1,400,000 active people. He said he was going to cut $60 billion more out of the military budget than President Bush had planned to do, but that's over a period of about 4 years, so it's not a significant cut. I would it would appear to me there'll be some modest reductions in our military force structure, but there'll be an improved capability to intervene around the world with that military structure, but the military spending will remain at about the same level that it is today.
What kind of debate do you think is happening within the military right now about the direction it should head in?
Well, the military is, I'm still convinced that they believe that if they maintain a strong military posture and with the capability to attack, destroy, and kill efficiently, they can serve their country best. Now, that leaves open the possibility that the United States might establish a strictly humanitarian force of hospital ships, medical personnel, civilian administrators that could be used as a disaster relief force. I think as a nation, if we wish to get into that, then we ought to proceed in that direction, expand our FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, to take care of conditions in other countries. But I do not think it is wise to try to have the military perform functions for which it was not designed. If you want to waste your money, put it through the Pentagon. Pentagon is the most wasteful system we have in terms of spending money. If we want to have a humanitarian outfit, let's design one to serve that purpose, or put our money into the Red Cross or the United Nations or other groups, but not confuse the role of the military with the humanitarian efforts on a permanent basis.
My guest is retired Rear Admiral Jean LaRocque, director of the Center for Defense Information. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Admiral Jean LaRocque, director of the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. Admiral, you recently returned from 2 weeks traveling around the world examining the effectiveness of U.N. peacekeeping forces. You went to Cambodia, Cyprus, Syria, Israel, and El Salvador. What specifically were you looking for?
Well, we were trying to decide whether the United Nations forces were doing any good and whether they were worth the money we were spending on them. And whether or not we could continue to put more forces around the world.
Who organized the trip?
The United Nations Association, and the president went with us, President Luck, and it was a very interesting trip of about 16 people, three of us military, one on active duty, and two of us retired officers. And it was very illuminating to see what was happening in each of those countries.
Could you give us a summary report of what you saw?
Well, each country, of course, is different. I think Cambodia is the most complex. We have about 45 to 50,000 UN peacekeeping forces in that country. There are only about 10 or 15 Americans there, however. But the costs are very high. The costs are running about $2 billion a year in Cambodia. In the United States, pays 30% of that for the peacekeeping. We pay 25% of the regular budget. But I think it's a mission impossible there. Actually, I don't think that's his actual title, Prince Sihanouk, met with us for about 5 hours, and he said that the United Nations has turned his country into a colony of the United Nations, and I think there's some substance to that. He said that you all will be out of here before long because you don't have enough money to stay. It's costing the UN about $2 billion a year. I think it's a mission impossible for the United Nations to get in and try to register everybody repatriate the Cambodians that have gone over to Thailand, keep the Vietnamese out, and hold elections and establish a government.
In examining the peacekeeping forces, did you reach any conclusion about how peacekeeping forces have to be trained or equipped differently than forces who are dispatched to fight war?
Well, interestingly enough, the peacekeeping forces are not trained at all. Take the situation in Cambodia. The United Nations decides to send X number of troops there. Then you go around to the various countries of the world and say, will you send a company, a brigade, or 200 people? And they say yes or no. If they say yes, they order a brigade to go. Now, people can refuse to go because it's a volunteer assignment, but most everybody goes because most troops that come from Bangladesh or Fiji or China, Russia, or wherever, they're kind of bored at home. And so they go for the excitement. They go because they feel they're doing some good in that country, and they go because the pay is also quite good. You get a considerable increase in your pay if you go, and it's for 6 months, so there isn't any peacekeeping training per se. They're trained as military people. They're disciplined. They can take care of themselves in the field, but when their 6 months is up, they're sent back home again.
Were you asked to make recommendations to the United Nations?
Yes, we met with the Undersecretary Generals and with the various ambassadors, including our own ambassador, Mr. Perkins. We don't really have any firm recommendations except to proceed with caution where we're going to introduce our forces. Because in March of last year, we had only 9,000 peacekeeping forces in the whole world, 9,000. Today, they're well over 50,000 in the 13 countries where they are present, and we're talking about adding more peacekeeping forces into Bosnia and Croatia, and of course now they're moving to send about 8,000 troops into Mozambique off the African coast, and at the rate it's going, the numbers of people involved are going to be so large as to be difficult to control the situations in each country. And also the costs are just absolutely ballooning, perhaps out of control, because the nations of the world seem somewhat reluctant to continue to support it financially.
So are you suggesting that the UN has to scale back its peacekeeping operations?
Not so much scale back, but be very careful about where they introduce new components. Once they decide to do it, then you have to fund it and provide the people and control it. There needs to be more control at the headquarters in New York. The Undersecretary General, Mr. Goulding, is a first-class British civil authority. He's very smart, but he has a very little staff, and he needs intelligence. He needs satellite information. He needs an operations room to deal with all these peacekeeping forces around the world. The UN is moving into a new era, and I hope they can adjust fast enough to accommodate the changes that are taking place in the world.
How come your trip examining peacekeeping forces didn't take you to Bosnia-Herzegovina?
Well, we had to receive the authority from the commander of the unit in that country, in every country, and he would not accept us. He has enough problems himself dealing with the Cyrus Vances and the Lord Owens and the congressmen, the senators, and the people from all over the world visiting there. They didn't need another independent body coming in, and we really didn't push to go there.
Now, you're about to go to Okinawa. What will you be looking for there?
Well, it's now some 45 years after the end of World War II. We still have a lot of military forces in Japan, including on the island of Okinawa. And it is our view that it is time now to bring those troops home. But the occasion for the visit actually is at the invitation of the governor of Okinawa to participate in an opening ceremony for a peace monument that is being dedicated in about 2 months. And they're going to list on that peace monument something that I think all nations ought to consider doing. That is, they're going to list the names of the dead, both the enemy and friend, that is, the Japanese, the Okinawans, and the Americans, and the civilians. Everyone that was killed is going to be on that monument. And I don't know the number, but it's thousands and thousands who were killed. And that really is the story of war, a remembrance of those, all the people who were killed, not just the victorious ones.
So these will be people killed in Okinawa?
People killed just in the battle for that barren island of Okinawa. Lots of Americans were killed, lots of Okinawans, lots of civilians.
The world has changed since the end of the Cold War. Our military strategy, our foreign policy has changed. Do you feel that we're just experiencing changes, or do you feel that things have really become unglued?
Oh, I don't think that the world has changed tremendously since the end of the Cold War. Just the Soviet communism has disappeared. There's still much of the beauty, charm, and grace in the world that was extant before, and there's still much of the ugly, brutal coarseness that exists. And we cannot expect any immediate changes for the better or for the worse in the years ahead. But we must make sure that we in America stay strong economically, politically, and socially if we're to play a significant role in the world in the future.
Retired Rear Admiral Gene LaRocque. He's the director of the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.